I chose to deviate from the lectionary text for today, partly because I found it a very, very confusing parable and I couldn't quite decide what it all meant. So you have to forgive me. We're not in Luke today. We're in Mark. The little story of the storm on the lake that's told in three of the four Gospels in much the same way. I like Mark partly because one of the very first courses I took when I was studying theology and New Testament, I had to write an essay on Mark. And I chose to do this story. Now, I had no idea what I did with it or anything like that, but somehow or other, Mark's version always has stuck with me. When Mark wrote his gospel, the headlines were just about as bad then as they are now. Jerusalem was in ruins. The temple had been destroyed. The emperor's favorite pastime was thinking up new ways for Christians to die. And then there was even fighting among Christians themselves, with whole families that were being torn apart by their conflicting loyalties. There were false messiahs setting themselves up on every street corner, each of them claiming to know something of God's intentions. Everything seemed threatened. And those who believed in Jesus must have wondered at times whether they had been fooled. Surely this was not the way that things were supposed to be. Not this chaos and not all this darkness. And that's, of course, when Mark told the story once again, when he wrote it down, so they would not forget it, so we would not forget it. Now, it's a story that's rich in symbolism and levels of meaning, because the sea in Jewish writing was both a place and a power of darkness and evil. It was wild and threatening. God, the Creator, as the psalmist told us, put limits on the seas, and as Redeemer of Israel, God tamed the sea at the Exodus. And he used it to stop the disobedient Jonah in his tracks and send him back to his proper business as a prophet. And all of this, for Mark's early readers, would have been in the background as Mark tells the story. And of course, on another level, there's the dramatic contrast, which Melody highlighted, between the total sense of trust that Jesus has, his trust in his Father that allows him to sleep peacefully in a very threatening situation. And then the fear of the disciples. What a contrast. In their defense, I think it must have been quite a gale to arouse such terror, because they knew this lake and its sudden storms. And a number of these men were fishermen who operated boats for a living. So if they were scared, it must have been quite a storm. The image is powerful, I think, because a storm at sea and a threatened boat are obviously symbolic of a host of threatening and stormy situations, both inner and outer, which people experience as likely to capsize their boat. Winston Churchill called one of his volumes of the history of the Second World War The Gathering Storm. And what a storm it proved to be. And how many nations and peoples and races were sunk in its wake. And the world's history from that time, of course, for many people, continues in the very same vein. Here in our congregation are people from Rwanda, from Cambodia, from northern Uganda, from Zimbabwe and Nigeria and Haiti, where it must have seemed, and it still seems in some places, that God is sleeping or that God has left his post, that so much darkness is allowed to prevail. And with no attempt at all to trivialize the horrors of such places as these and the things that people have endured, I think there are very few lives that, if we live long enough, will escape the high waves and the deep troughs that will seem to threaten your person and even your life. Every single one of us here this morning who has any measure of life experience at all has had seasons of pain, of terrible loss, and doubt. It is part of being human. A marriage that began with romance and confetti ended with anger and alienation. And what God has joined together came apart at the seams, and we wonder, where was God in the coming apart? Maybe a nagging pain has sent you to the doctor only to learn that the cancer, long in remission, has returned, and it quickly begins to steal your strength and your hope. And then we wonder, in the pain, about the loving care of God. Maybe there's an empty place at the table where we had shared our food and our life. And we wonder about a God whose world holds such loss. There are deep wounds inflicted by parents who cared too little and gave violence instead of love. And all of us wonder, where on earth was God? I think for some of us, these experiences are like exposed nerves, because if we touch them, we still cry out in pain and we wonder why a loving God would allow us and others to suffer in these ways. Jesus, do you not care if we drown? The story turns on the moment when Jesus awakes and he calms the raging waters, leaving the awestruck disciples wondering, who is this? For to quell the wind and the waves is no doubt divine work. In the terrible persecutions that the early church faced, they must have been comforted with the recital of this story of the boat in the storm. But this story is for us too, when the waters of chaos seem poised to overwhelm our world and your world and my world. What is it that you fear that might overwhelm you? The story of the boat in the storm has a meaning that's larger than some single incident in the life of Jesus. In fact, I think, in brief, this is the story of his life and the saving mission that he trusted in God's power, even when he was caught in a storm of cruelty and injustice and oppression that ultimately killed him. And he rose on the third day from the sleep of death, and he has the power to grant his divine life to all who come to him. And I think that when this relationship comes alive for us, there can be a sense of calm, of finding a resource that's beyond our own fragile resources, something within us that says, peace be still in the midst of all. You heard the reading this morning from 2 Corinthians, and no less a great Christian than St. Paul writes in the part of his letter to the Corinthians that David read about the difficulties he faced, about troubles and hardships and beatings and imprisonment, sleepless nights and hunger, and people who misunderstood him, which might have been the hardest thing of all. I think none of us have such a list as this. But he ends with these words, dying yet we live on, beaten yet not killed, sorrowful yet always rejoicing, poor yet making many rich, having nothing yet possessing everything. Is this crazy? Paul triumphs over what would destroy most people, he says, in the power of God, who enables him to continue to show patience and understanding, even kindness and love, and to speak the truth. This is indeed the peace that passes all understanding that Jesus promised his disciples on the night before his death. Paul offers himself, I think, as exhibit A in evidence of this trustworthiness of God and of God's love. God does not spare us the abysses, the high waves and the troughs between. But he does support us in every depth. God can make a way out of no way, said the leaders of the Black Freedom Movement. In a world full of menace, or personal storms, it often seems as if God is absent or asleep. But God's presence and love comes our way through what is often the simple human actions of ordinary people showing kindness. God's faithfulness is shown to us in flesh and in blood. This week was a difficult one for our family because on Tuesday, our granddaughter Georgia, who will soon be 8, was injured coming home from school in London, England. And it turned out to be a very serious matter of life and death, which is what the surgeon said after surgery. The evening of Georgia's surgery, 40 people met at her Anglican church to pray. The anesthetist who accompanied her and our daughter in the ambulance from the local hospital to a much larger one with a pediatric center called every single day this week to ask how she was. When Jennifer went home after 3 days to have a better sleep and do a few chores, she said, she told me yesterday, she was walking out the door with an armload of shirts to take to the laundry because she couldn't do them. And a friend who was coming in the door, unannounced at the very same moment, said, "I'll take those," and grabbed them from her hand, lifting them out of her hands. You see, God's faithfulness is shown in flesh and in blood. And when you reach out your hand, it is as the hand of God that the grieving and the lonely and the frightened experience it. I think I told this story before, but maybe it bears repeating. One day I was visiting someone who knew that she was dying. I spoke to her about the hope of the Christian, as our creed says, in life, in death, in life beyond death, God is with us. And she said to me, "But I don't believe that anymore." I stood there silently for a few moments. And as I did, I thought, you know what? I've never been this old and in this kind of pain, hearing the doctor tell me that I'm going to die, lonely, no family, few friends left. Maybe this will be someday, will be me, I don't know. So I said, because it seemed like the right thing to do, "Let me have faith for you. Let my faith carry you for now." I didn't give any thought to whether or not that was theologically correct, but it seemed that what I have sometimes done when my own faith is not up to much, when my trusting isn't what it should be. You see, always in a community of believers, there will be someone whose faith is more robust than yours, someone whose prayers go deeper, and whose trust is firmer. And they have strengthened me time after time. I have leaned on them, probably with no idea from them that they were ever keeping me going. But they have carried me along. And her faith began to take hold again. And I can tell you that she died in the peace of Christ. Barbara Brown Taylor, the American Episcopal priest and writer, has a wonderful collection of sermons that's entitled Gospel Medicine. And I just want to read what she says in the foreword because it seemed to me so appropriate to this. She says, "We are all doctors of the gospel. We are all tellers of the story, which does not heal by taking away the pain, but by giving us a way to live with it, naming it, sharing it, enduring it. To run from what hurts seems natural. To face it is not. And yet that is where our true health lies. If we are able to turn toward the pain of the world and toward our pain and let it do its work, the result may be hearts broken open to God and one another. Those who lose their lives shall find them. In Scripture, there are stories of anger, of abandonment, of fear and apocalypse. But so are God's promises there, messengers and tender mercies. Most lives contain some of each, although few of us ever have the words to describe them. And that is why we need the gospel balm. Smearing it over the skin of our days, we may begin to warm to the stories that still describe us, stories that know us better than we know ourselves. Their strength mends our weakness. Their truth thaws our falseness. Their life disinfects our death. Hearing them and telling them, we surrender ourselves to the physician who heals us with words, dressing our wounds by stitching the raw edges of our lives to his. That's, in fact, what the story did for me this week. And I pray that it will help to do the same thing for you. And as we do, as we live it, as we tell it, I think we help to restore the world to health, one blessed word and one person at a time. Amen.